great, great joy to welcome to the pulpit one of the CBC's world-class faculty. When I came to CBC 3 years ago, I was instantly in awe of the faculty at the school. Quality people. People who love the Lord, seek His face. They do so for His glory and for your good. Your faculty loves you. Do you know that? And they do so because of leadership. And they do so because of their own hearts. And today that leadership and heart is best expressed in this man coming today, the chair of the Church Ministries Division, your own, give it up, all you got, Dr. Mike Jaffe today. Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you. It was an awkward moment when one day I experienced two emotions simultaneously, neither of which I was proud of. I had just received a check from my church treasurer for the evangelist, for whom we took a love offering that week. And as I typically did, I cast a little glance at it. Let me backtrack a little bit as to why those two emotions were present. A little over a year prior to that, I was sitting home ready to go to my place of ministry, which was a church I was associate pastor of. And I received a call from the district office asking me to prayerfully consider a church planting opportunity in upstate New York. I was surprised. I had this deep sense in my heart that my whole world was going to change. We ended up going there, investigating things, and we came away with a conviction that this is where God was leading my wife and I, and my 2-year-old son at the time. Now, it wasn't long after that I was at a district council meeting. It was my first district council meeting as a new pastor. And I was a young man in ministry, very idealistic about not only ministry, but what God had for me. And, you know, during the particular district council, various people came forward and they introduced various people. And in this particular occasion, it was the district evangelists that were a part of our district's evangelistic team. And they all had their booths at the end, and I felt drawn and led toward one particular evangelist. And we had been there some months in this new church planting opportunity, and we felt the need to bring in an evangelist to come and we were going to do an outreach into the community, and I was excited about that. And I stopped by and the particular desk where he was and the particular booth where he was, and there he was. I introduced myself and I said, ask him, would you be available to come to our church? And he was all smiles. And then he asked me the question. Well, it wasn't really a question, but tell me a little bit about your church. Well, my church was, at that particular time, we're just a few months in, it was a new church planting. It had about 50 people. As far as I was concerned, after those months, it was a real success story. We were meeting in a farm building, a little farmer's hall, that we were able to rent after a period of months for $45 a week, utilities paid. And, you know, I mean, it wasn't much. As a matter of fact, that's an understatement. It wasn't anything. I mean, it was ugly. It had no parking. It generally smelled of the tobacco and alcohol and beer that the group that rented it out previous to us used it for, because we could only rent it for Sunday mornings and Wednesday nights. But it was our place. And, you know what? It was $45 a week, utilities paid. So, you know, I was telling him all about this, and you know how you read people's body language? And his body language went considerably south. And the message or the body vibes that I got from him were, well, okay, let's exchange phone numbers, and I'll give you a call, and here's my phone number in case I'm not able to get a hold of you. But it almost reeked of politeness. 2 weeks afterwards, when I hadn't received a call, I decided that I would call him. And I said, "Remember me?" And there was a pause, where he was clearly remembering me. And I was just saying, "Well, you know, we're still excited about having you come. Would you be able to come?" And there was a pause. And finally he said, "Okay, what are some of the possible dates?" And we agreed on a date, and we were excited. Well, that day came. And the evangelist came, and I took him a tour of our wonderful facility. And it was in the condition that was generally worse than it was usually in in that particular time that we found it. And it was obvious to me that, you know, I had to get this place ready. So he kind of stood in there and watched as I was really in a hurry. I had to get it ready, so I was sweeping and I was mopping. I was doing everything I possibly could, and he was standing there watching. And then finally I thought to myself, you know what, I better get him to the motel. And I, you know, took him in the car. I was going to come back and work on the, you know, on the make get it ready for our first Sunday. You know, it was meeting. You know, and actually it was on a Saturday evening for the Sunday evening and before the Sunday morning. And as we were going back there, you know, he made this comment to me. He says, "You know, an evangelist like myself has to be very careful about the churches he ministers at. Because we have to be careful that we don't get a reputation of being a small church evangelist." Well, being very young and idealistic, I hadn't been around the block many times. He has no idea what that did to my spirit. And how my heart, my head hung and how my heart felt. I dropped him off, and I was saying, "Okay, God, turn lemon into lemonade." Drove back to the Quonset hut that was our little Grange hall, finished sweeping, finished mopping, and got it ready. Well, as the meetings went on, I have to say, he preached reasonably well. But it was very obvious to me he didn't want to be there. It was obvious to me in the altar services that he was just more than happy just to get the quick ride to the motel, that he was just going to go through the motions. And he did. And at the end of the evangelistic meetings, when the time came, when the treasurer gave me the check, and I looked at it, and I had those two conflicting emotions. Because although we were only 50 people, our people were usually very generous. But not this time. It was an embarrassing offering. And my first emotion was embarrassment. But right after that came a second emotion. You know, it's a heck of a lot more than he deserves. Well, D.A. Carson wrote in his book entitled, or in his series of sermons entitled, "The Cross in Christian Ministry," a number of things, one of which where he makes the point that Christian leaders largely have traded in the cross for hierarchical control models, respect of their peers, and the applause of men. But you know what? It's not only Christian leadership. You go to a typical Christian bookstore, and you will find book after book and wall after wall that are self-help oriented, self-esteem driven, Christian success stories of all sorts. And these things are good in their place, and well they should be read, and well they should be written. But I can't help but wonder, because this begs the question, where are the books on the cross? My message this morning is entitled The Glory of the Cross, subtitled Embracing a Cross-Centered Worldview. And before we go any further, I think we need to define worldview. What does one mean when they use the term worldview? Well, let me give you two definitions. Michael Palmer defines a worldview as a set of beliefs and practices that shape a person's approach to the most important issues of life. Mark Cosgrove defines it this way: as a set of assumptions or beliefs about reality that affects how we think and how we live. So what then is a cross-centered worldview? Well, a cross-centered worldview is simply one that interprets all of life, our assumptions about reality, our beliefs, our practices, through the prism of the cross. We live today in a compartmentalized, in a day where the cross is compartmentalized, marginalized, and reduced. What do I mean by that? We live in a time where when we think about the cross, we think about it as an important subject for our preaching or an important element for our worship, even though, frankly, we're preaching less and less about it and singing choruses that are less and less oriented or devoted to it. But nonetheless, that's how we kind of reduce it. It's the main focus of our preaching, or it's a main element of our worship. Or we limit our view of the cross is kind of limited to a fundamental focus of theology, and clearly it is that. Or even, and maybe in a more significant way, we limit it to the means of our eternal salvation. And all of those things are real, and all of these things are true. But in our text this morning, 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verses 18-31, Paul reveals that his theology of the cross is so much more than even all those three wonderful things. So at this particular point, I'd like you to turn in your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 1 and verses 18-31. Where we read the following, and I want to read the entire text. The message of the cross is foolishness to those who are perishing, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God. For it is written, I will destroy the wisdom of the wise. The intelligence of the intelligent I will frustrate. Where is the wise man? Where is the scholar? Where is the philosopher of this age? Has not God made foolish the wisdom of this world? For since in the wisdom of God the world through its own wisdom did not know him, God was pleased through the foolishness of what was preached to save those who believe. Jews demand miraculous signs, and Greeks look for wisdom. But we preach Christ crucified, a stumbling block to the Jews and foolishness to the Gentiles. But to those whom God has called, that's you and me. But to those whom God has called, both Jews and Greeks, Christ, the power of God and the wisdom of God. For the foolishness of God is wiser than man's wisdom, and the weakness of God is stronger than man's strength. He goes on in verse 26. Brothers, think of what you were when you were called. Not many of you were wise by human standards. Not many were influential. Not many were of noble birth. But God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. God chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. He chose the lowly things of this world and the despised things and the things that are not to nullify the things that are, so no one may boast before him. It is because of him that you are in Christ Jesus, who has become for us wisdom from God, that is, our righteousness, holiness, and redemption. Therefore, as it is written, let him who boasts, boast in the Lord. Now, let's take just a few moments to examine the context of this particular passage. It can be argued, and I will argue, that although the Corinthian church had multitudes of problems, and I delineate them here on the slide that's next, a multitude of problems that included carnal attitudes, factions in the church. You know, I'm of Paul, and I am of Apollos, and I am of Cephas, and I am of Christ. A tolerance of sin in chapter 5, where they tolerated the sin of the immoral brother. Or in chapter 6, unresolved disputes where Paul says to them, you can't even solve your problems and you are wise. Idolatrous practices in chapter 10. The abuse of the Lord's Supper in chapter 11, where the wealthy were partaking of their meals and leaving the poor to be without. Disorderly worship, and really a lot more. And while I will argue that these were problems, I will argue that they were symptoms. But the greater problem was an inadequate worldview when it came to the cross. See, the Corinthians had a compartmentalized, marginalized, reduced understanding of the cross. We even see this in Paul as he spends much of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians defending his own ministry. On one occasion in 2 Corinthians, he said, you know, I came to you not even asking for your support, even though I had a right to it. He says that actually in 1 Corinthians chapter 9 and again in 2 Corinthians. You know, I worked hard among you so I would not be a burden to you. But what's your response? That just diminished me, he said, in your eyes. You would prefer these, on another occasion, Second Corinthians, he said, you would prefer these super apostles that would require things of you and demand of you. You know, what were the Corinthians doing? Were they really rejecting Paul? No. They were really rejecting his worldview. They were doing that because they were rejecting his example, because they really wanted no part of it. The exegetical idea of what I have, what I'm going to be talking about this morning with regard to this passage, the exegetical idea of this passage, the big idea, is simple. The cross is God's expression of wisdom and power. See, the cross is counterintuitive. It is the counterintuitive revelation of God's value system. The cross must be the lens through which the Christian perceives all aspects of life. It is more than simply the means of salvation. It's a worldview. It's the viewpoint, the prism by which all of our assumptions of reality need to be processed through. The cross from the perspective of the world. The cross is foolishness to the world. The message, Paul said, the message, the kerygma, that word means that the actual essence of the message. The message of the cross is foreign to all human perceptions of life. The cross was a scandalous embarrassment to the Romans. Only criminals, the worst criminals, would suffer at the cross. That Christians would teach that God's Messiah would be crucified was scandalous to them. To the Jew, it was a stumbling block. Deuteronomy said that only the cursed one would die upon the tree. So to the Jew, it was a stumbling block. And to the Greek, well, it was absolutely ridiculous. Gordon Fee writes this: no human being in his right mind or otherwise would have dreamed of God's scheme of redemption through a crucified Messiah. Now, I have to admit that at times I kind of fall prey to it myself. Periodically, when I read the Gospels, I have to say, and I know this sounds bad, but at times I'm offended at the way Jesus died. I am. I would want it to be written differently. I mean, I know the value of the cross, and I know that he had to go there. But it's the way that he did it, so blamelessly, so innocently, without putting up any defense. It kind of violates my sense of the way it should be. There's a part of me, a large part of me, that when I read the various gospel writers' accounts of the crucifixion of Jesus, wants the story to read a little bit differently. Part of me just wants Jesus for 15 minutes while hanging on the cross to look at his scoffers and those who are saying, if you are the Son of God, come down from the cross. Part of me is just wanting him to, for 15 minutes, take those people and turn them into lizards. So they'll just crawl around on their bellies. So he'd make a statement as to who he really was. And then after 15 minutes, when he sufficiently made his point, turn them back into scoffers. And then resume, thank you, Chris, then resume his death on the cross. But that's not the way God chose to do it. It is just the opposite. In terms of how God views, opposite of how God views wisdom. The compartmentalized and marginalized and reduced cross enabled the Corinthians, who highly valued human wisdom, to do as we often do. Add wisdom to the cross. In other words, if we can keep the cross in a compartment, then we can just add our way of life and our lifestyle to the cross and reduce it. It's hard, but Gordon Fee calls the message of the cross God's folly, and it feels like God's folly. We get the sense that it's God's folly. His answer to the wisdom of the world is a crucified Messiah. See, although the cross is, from the perspective of the world, foolishness and scandalous, from the perspective of God, it's the exact revelation of his wisdom. D.A. Carson calls this deliciously ironic and entirely appropriate. And he goes on to say, to God, human wisdom is rebellious folly and human strength, moral weakness. See, the Corinthians, in all their wisdom, possessed example after example of moral weakness. See, wisdom doesn't make you moral. Wisdom doesn't give you power, but only a crucified Christ does that. Amen. See, God's answer to the wisdom of this world is to choose the things that are not. Notice verses 26 and following as Paul addresses the whole context of the Corinthian church. God's answer to the wisdom of this world is to choose the things that are not to nullify the things that are. But we stubbornly want to use the things that are to nullify the things that are not. One of the most precious people in my life, and I don't really have time to get into it, was the pastor that I worked under in my first place of ministry. Again, it's kind of a long story, and I'll try to make it very quick. But after graduating seminary with my Master of Divinity degree, I thought, you know what? I should be able to command a pretty decent salary in the ministry. And, you know, and when I started to survey the opportunities, there were a couple opportunities that jumped right out at me. The first opportunity paid me a reasonably decent salary. The second opportunity could only pay me $150 a week and no housing. Now, that was a long time ago, but it still was pretty lousy in that time. And while we were at both churches, my wife and I came to the conclusion after visiting both churches and experiencing the people, a conclusion we didn't want to come to, that God was calling us to the second one. And we didn't know how we were going to do it. And I was thinking all these kind of bitter thoughts. This is what I spent 8 years in college and seminary for? $150 a week? But that was God's answer for my life. But a wonderful thing happened to me the 5 years that I stayed in that ministry. Well, first of all, I did get a pay raise. But that came afterwards. But the real blessing was the man that God called me to. To this very day, I have never met a more godly man who lived godliness in his life, who was concerned about my well-being. You know, even though the church couldn't pay me much, you know, most of you who have pastored before, you know this is pretty rare. He said, you know what? I really want to invest in your ministry. How about it? I give you the opportunity to preach every Sunday night. And after a couple years, he said, well, once a quarter, why don't you preach on Sunday morning? And I'll preach on Sunday night. I mean, he made me a real partner in ministry. He was a man without ego. He was a minister, a Christian leader without ego. And how many of you know that that's not all together all that common? But he was a wonderful man that I'll never forget. A wonderful man who for 5 years poured into my life. A wonderful man who taught me what it meant to be a Christian. Who poured character in my life, who visibly and daily represented Jesus to me. So how many dollars a week is that worth? It turns out an awful lot. It turns out you can't even measure it. You see, all human standards are nothing but standards of this world. I want to say it again. All human standards are nothing but the standards of this world. So why the cross? So no one could boast before him, Paul says in verse 31, 30. Why? So that we alone would trust in him alone as our wisdom, our righteousness, our holiness, and our redemption, verse 30. Why the cross? So that all of our boasting would be in the Lord. So what about our compartmentalization, marginalized, and reduced concept of the cross? Do we possess a cross-centered worldview or a Corinthian worldview? The modern Pentecostal evangelical church, if you are listening, and of course, those of you who take my strategies for evangelism and discipleship class, this is going to be old news. But the modern evangelical and Pentecostal church often preaches a crossless, Jesus will make your life better gospel. Can you imagine Peter in Acts chapter 2 preaching that gospel to those who were gathered? Can you imagine Peter in Acts chapter 2 saying these words? Do you lack peace in your life? Are you lonely? Are you sad? Come to Jesus and he'll make your life better. But that's our version of it, isn't it? We've all heard it before. Maybe we preach it. No, it won't go that far. See, the modern evangelical Pentecostal church often Pentecostal pastor often exchanges the cross-centered worldview of the ministry for a professional one that's built upon prestige rather than servanthood and sacrifice. One that's measured by a certain caricature, like driving the right car and wearing the right clothing. Biblical view? A cross-centered view? The modern evangelical Pentecostal Christian often values people from their perspective of social standing rather than viewing the ground level at the foot of the cross. By the way, this is something I really would like to encourage you guys with. Every student here should be a candidate to be your friend. Every student here should be treated with equal value. Every student here deserves love. There's no student here that's beneath your social standing or above your social standing. The ground's level at the foot of the cross. And if you don't believe that, and if you don't live that, you don't understand a cross-centered worldview. The modern evangelical Pentecostal leader often has few qualms with sacrificing almost anything at the altar of ministry success. Don't let that be you. In other words, while for many, not all, many evangelicals and Pentecostals, the cross is an article of faith, it doesn't always penetrate our values and how we live. So how about you? Will you embrace the cross-centered worldview? Or will you take the easier route of a compartmentalized, marginalized, and reduced cross? Jesus said, The servant is not greater than his master. Jesus said, the servant is not greater than his master. Jesus said, the servant is not greater than his master. Does the way of the cross offend you? Or does it inspire you? The way of the crucified Messiah is our way. The worldview of the crucified Messiah must be our worldview. The cross must be, and I'd like our worship team to come, the cross must be both our way of salvation and our way of life. And we should never in our minds ever dream of separating the two. Jesus is calling us to the cross. But not only to believe in the cross as the Corinthians did, but to live the cross as the Corinthians did not. My challenge to you this morning, my call to you this morning, as we stand together, is to be inspired by the cross, to embrace the cross, to treasure the cross, by how you live your life. In Jesus' name, let it be so. The altars are open. I would hope that you would take a few moments to ponder the cross as the basis for your ministry, not only your ministry, but your life, as our worship team leads us in When I Survey the Wondrous Cross. Would you